The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening, everyone. This is my fourth Monday night teaching in a row, and that means Gil will be back next week. His retreat ends on Sunday, so he'll be returning on Monday night next week. On Saturday, we had the privilege of having Stephen Batchelor here with us. How many of you were able to attend that? So, a few of you. I always love listening to Stephen. He's got such a fresh perspective on the teachings. And after his talk in the next day or so, a couple of people asked me some questions about it. One of the things that Stephen does is he really kind of looks at the views that we have around the teachings of Buddhism and questions those views. So he really, he doesn't take anything for granted. Doesn't take anything as set in stone. And he really kind of just wants to clear away things and see for himself, what does he understand from what the teachings say? And so a couple of people expressed some things, and there was a little confusion on the part of at least one person. And so I thought I would revisit what he had to say, let you, for those of you who weren't here, I'll recap what he had to say, and then explore in particular the areas where he really is shifting the view, and just give you some thoughts, some personal reflections on it. This is a personal exploration in terms of my personal understanding of what Stephen said. I got to hear him with everyone else and only discussed with him as much as I had opportunity to ask questions that day. So it is my understanding of what Stephen said, not necessarily what Stephen said. Keep that in mind. And it's also based on my own understanding of the Buddhist teachings. So this will be a personal exploration. I'm not proposing that there's any right or wrong here in this exploration. It's really just a thinking about. And I think Stephen also said, as I recall, for himself, this is a work in progress. So partly, I felt, too, that this led on fairly well from the talk I gave last week. I talked about views last week and how holding views tightly gets in our way of being able to see things as they are, that when we hold views tightly, we limit ourselves in terms of what we can really take in. And so Stephen really doesn't hold views tightly. He really explores and investigates. And this can cause some discomfort, some confusion. It can also create interest and curiosity, which is what I'm hoping to evoke here this evening. So the main points, I'd like to just kind of review some of the main points that Stephen made on Saturday. And he was basically wanting to look at foundational teachings of the Buddha to see what at its core did the Buddha actually say, and what does that mean? And as his exploration of this, he used in particular the first discourse that the Buddha gave after he was awakened, which is a description of his understanding of what led to his awakening, which was the Four Noble Truths. The usual perspective that we have on the Four Noble Truths, and Stephen also went over this, is, and I'll just state them here in case there's any of you who are not familiar with the Four Noble Truths, they're usually stated as the truth of suffering, that there's suffering in the world, suffering in our lives, suffering in our experience. The truth of the cause of suffering, which is said to be craving or wanting things to be other than they are. The truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering, that which we cultivate in order to realize the ending of suffering, and that is the Noble Eightfold Path, comprised of wise understanding, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. And the usual perspective on this is that it's understood in this way that there's suffering and a cause of suffering, and then there's a possibility for that suffering to end and a path or a cause for that ending of suffering. So it's stated in these terms of suffering is an effect and the craving is its cause. And the ending of suffering is an effect and the path, or the Eightfold Path, is the cause for the ending of suffering. That's the usual way that it's described, and the understanding of why the Buddha put it in those terms is that it was kind of following a medical model. And this is in the commentaries. The Buddhist commentaries talk about the medical model that the Four Noble Truths is addressing what the Buddha saw as the fundamental ill of humanity. And what's the illness? It's suffering. And in so that's the first thing you do when you go to a doctor. You find out, well, what's the illness? And then you find out, what's the cause of the illness? And the Buddha says that this wanting, this craving is the cause. And what's the prognosis for the illness? The Buddha says, well, there's a good prognosis for the illness if you follow the prescription, the Eightfold Path. So that's the usual understanding, the usual perspective on the Eightfold Path. An additional piece of this usual understanding of the Eightfold Path is what it means for suffering to end. It's clear in the texts that the Buddha doesn't mean that all physical pain ends with the ending of suffering. It's something else. And often in the teachings, as Stephen said the other day, the traditional Vipassana teachers in this country describes, well, there's the pain, and then there's the reaction to the pain. And you hear us saying this a lot. So there's the pain and there's the reaction to the pain, and it's the reaction that's really the dukkha, that's the suffering that we can become free of. We're not going to become free of physical unpleasant sensations. We can become free of mental reactivity. That is one way that the understanding of this freedom from suffering is understood in our Western Buddhist in the Western Buddhist Vipassana tradition. But a kind of the way, the more traditional way that the Theravadan school understands the ending of suffering, and that many of the Buddhist schools actually understand the ending of suffering as being some form of transcendence of suffering through being released from a cycle of rebirth. That it is this continual propelling through a cycle of continued one existence after another that is the suffering that is deeply embedded into Buddhist thought. That this is the suffering that we get released from, and that the ending of suffering is getting released from that cycle of rebirth. So the path of practice as being a release from this cycle of rebirth, that is basically, as Stephen pointed out, that's the basic framework that spiritual practice was oriented towards at the time of the Buddha. That was the understanding of how life was lived, that there was this ongoing cycle of rebirth, of existence after existence after existence, called samsara, which the point of the spiritual practice is to become free from that samsara. So in Stephen's proposal, I saw several main reasons why he is interested in exploring and questioning this usual perspective on the Four Noble Truths, one of which being that he says he really just has a very difficult time seeing this idea of rebirth as being a possibility. He said something like, I used to just try to be agnostic about it, and really I guess I have to say that I don't know, but based on what I understand about the mind and the body, based on what we understand scientifically, I just really have trouble seeing this rebirth thing. So that's one aspect of his own view that he's coming to the teachings with. And he's particularly interested in understanding, as I understand it, he's interested in understanding how can he understand the Buddhist teachings, how can he understand them without this framework of rebirth? Or is it absolutely necessary to have this framework of rebirth in order to understand what the Buddha said? He especially was pointing to the fact that in this first discourse of the Buddha, he said that the definition of suffering was given as birth is suffering, old age is suffering, death is suffering, and that that we're not going to free ourselves in this life from old age and death. And that, you know, if that's the definition of suffering that we're looking at, then, and the point of our path is to try to end suffering, then what that is talking about is some kind of rebirth. That to end this cycle of rebirth ends birth. It ends future old age and death. And that, this whole idea of craving causing suffering, which is the typical way that the Four Noble Truths are described, that the Second Noble Truth, wanting things to be other than they are, is what causes us to suffer, that craving is in some way impelling this round of rebirths. So he questions this framework of rebirth as being essential in terms of understanding the teachings. He also raised the question about the way the Four Noble Truths were stated. He said that this idea of the medical model is not in the suttas. I do believe it is in the early commentaries, but it's not in the suttas. The Buddha didn't put it out that way. He laid it out, actually, in this first discourse of the Buddha. He laid out the Four Noble Truths in terms of these four truths and three actions three tasks or three insights that are associated with each of the truths. And he thought it was odd that the layout of the Four Noble Truths was effect and cause. The effect being suffering, the cause being the wanting, the craving. Then the effect being the ending of suffering, and the cause being the path. He says it seemed very odd to him that this description of the Four Noble Truths didn't end with the goal of the practice. So he thought it was odd that the last of the Four Noble Truths was not where the practice leads. And so he started looking at the definitions of these truths, letting go, in a sense, of the names that have been given, the truth of suffering, the truth of the origin of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And he pointed out that those names given to those truths apparently could have been added later, that they may not have been the names the Buddha gave to those truths. And so he went right to the definitions of what those are and looked at the flow of the actions that are associated with each of the truths. In the typical understanding, there's each of these four truths and an action associated with each of the truths. So that the usual understanding is that the action for suffering is to understand suffering. We are enjoined to understand suffering, and through that understanding, we learn to see its cause, which is the wanting. And in seeing its cause, we are encouraged to let go of that cause, which leads to the cessation of suffering, which is to be realized. So letting go is the action associated with craving. Realizing the cessation of suffering is said to be the action for the third noble truth, and that is all accomplished through cultivating the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And so Stephen instead looked at those 12 actions, those 12 insights associated. There's three insights associated with each of the four truths, essentially around realizing the truth. Suffering, there is suffering, looking at the action associated with that truth, understanding suffering, that it should be understood, understanding what the action is for the truth, and then accomplishing it. Understanding suffering has been understood. And so he's looking at the flow of these from one to another and sees that they make logical sense if we look at the definitions of the truths. So the way he reads it is that understanding suffering, recognizing suffering and understanding it as it is, leads us to see that we want things to be other than they are. With suffering, suffering is what we don't want. And so therefore he sees that craving results from suffering. Now, this is a turning around of the cause and effect relationship of the Four Noble Truths. He sees craving as the effect of suffering. So suffering arises, craving follows. Suffering arises, we want it to be other than it is. So recognizing that craving, Stephen says that the problem with craving is that it essentially, it's out of alignment with, he didn't say it in these words, these terms I don't believe, but it's basically out of alignment with what is actually happening. So there's suffering and we want it to be otherwise. So we're out of alignment with that truth. And this is what craving basically gets in the way of being a fully functioning human being, because we're not able to act appropriately, speak appropriately, engage appropriately when we have this craving operating. And so he sees that letting go of craving is the next thing that would happen. So we understand suffering, which points us to craving as being a result of suffering, which shows us how the craving kind of gets in the way of being a fully functioning human being, so that we move towards letting go of craving, which leads us to realizing the cessation of craving, which the cessation of craving is the definition of the third noble truth. The definition of the third noble truth is not the cessation of suffering. It's the cessation of craving. And that's a piece that he highlighted for me that I thought was very interesting. I had really just looked at it as the cessation of suffering as being the point. But it's very clear in the text. The cessation of craving, realizing the cessation of craving, is the third noble truth. And the next place where Stephen really kind of alters the flow of things here is that he says, through that letting go of craving, we open ourselves to be able to engage in a path which leads towards being a fully functioning, appropriately responding human being here and now in this world. And he rephrases the Eightfold Path beautifully. I loved his rephrasing of the Eightfold Path. He called it, and I may have one of the words wrong here, but he called it, when craving is let go of, when craving ceases, we can meet the world with appropriate seeing, thinking, speaking, acting, working, engagement, recollection, and concentration. So that we fulfill a vision of a beautiful, wholesome, functional state, society, something along those lines. His view is that the Buddha was looking towards a new vision of here and now society, opening the possibility of a new way of life here and now in this world. So in this exploration, Stephen has two major shifts, and I'll go through each one. The first one is the view shift that he includes, is that he feels that in the Four Noble Truths, that the emphasis isn't so much that craving causes suffering, but that suffering causes craving. The second shift that he introduces is that the result of the path, or the aim of the path, is not some transcending of some cycle of rebirth, but it is here and now, in this world, in this very life, a better way to live. So for Stephen, the result of the path is very much here and now in this world, and not so much important about the part about what might happen or might not happen after he dies. So I'm going to look at each of these two shifts. The first one is that suffering causes craving. And this is a kind of a shift in the emphasis of the structure of the Four Noble Truths. The usual, as I said, is that craving causes suffering. That's the usual emphasis in the Four Noble Truths. And Stephen did not dispute that this is true. In fact, he affirmed that it's true. And this, the fact that craving causes suffering, is very easily visible to us if we take the time to pay attention to our experience. We see that when we want something to be other than it is, we endlessly try to change and manipulate the world and hold on to things. And in that holding on to things, we suffer when we either can't arrange the world the way we want it to be, or we suffer when we lose those things that we're holding so tightly to. So this understanding that craving causes suffering is easily visible through directly looking at experience. And it's also contained in quite a few of the teachings of the Buddha. There's a teaching in the Sutta Nipata that says that it's describing a series of liberating insights, of pairs of insights. And one section describes two insights into our experience that lead towards liberation. It says, one insight is that grasping is the basis of all suffering. The other insight is that by the complete cooling and cessation of all this grasping, there is no more arising of suffering. There's also contained in the teaching of dependent origination, which is a complex teaching, and I'm not going to try to go into it. But basically, it's a description of how our suffering is created. And there's a number of different cause and effect links that the Buddha describes as being how we go from this mind and body into suffering. And he describes that basically craving, wanting, leads to clinging, leads to holding on, leads to identification with what we hold on to, leads to suffering. That's a portion of this cycle of dependent origination. So the usual notion of craving causing suffering is supported through our own direct experience. It's supported through the understanding in the teachings. Looking at the shift to suffering causes craving. This is also easily verifiable in experience. We see pain arising, and because there's pain arising, we clearly see we want it to be otherwise. It's pretty direct, pretty clear, that when we suffer, we want it to end. We want to get rid of it. There's craving that arises out of suffering, that there's a causal link from suffering to craving. This is also found in this teaching on the cycle of dependent origination, several different ways that it can be seen in the cycle of dependent origination. One that Stephen pointed to is that one of the definitions of suffering is that basically suffering is kind of embedded in the mind and body flux, the aspects of the mind and body that are sometimes described as the five aggregates of experience, which I talked about last night. Again, I'm not going to go into that teaching. I talked about it for 40 minutes last night. But basically, so that the mind and body itself is can be seen to be, you know, imbued in a way with this notion of suffering. And in this path of dependent origination, it starts from the mind and body flux leading to the fact that because we have a mind and body, we have these sense bases. With these sense bases, there's contact with the sense bases. We experience things that are pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Out of that pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, there's a response. We like things that are pleasant. We want them. Craving. So out of that mind and body process, which is in some places in the suttas identified with suffering, we get craving. So this cycle, the teaching on dependent origination, is really a cycle. It talks about the cycle of suffering, which is basically an alternation between suffering and wanting, and suffering and wanting, and suffering and wanting, and suffering and wanting. There's no real beginning to that cycle. We could pick suffering as the cause and wanting as the effect, or we could pick wanting as the cause and suffering as the effect. Anywhere in that cycle, we could choose to enter into it. So this first shift that Stephen proposes, the shift to suffering causes craving, isn't really a fundamental shift in the teaching. It's not a major shift in understanding, because it's very well embedded in all the teachings of the Buddha that suffering causes craving. It is, however, a reframing of the Four Noble Truths, of the way the Four Noble Truths are traditionally understood. The second aspect that he talked about, the results of the path being here and now, visible in this world, that's the point, not so much the escape from the cycle of rebirth. So again, the traditional view of the third and fourth noble truths is that the Eightfold Path, the fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Path is the way leading to the cessation of suffering, which is the end of birth, aging, death, which is the end of this round of rebirths. So the attainment of the Eightfold Path is said to be the unconditioned, or Nibbana. That is also equated with this release from suffering and release from this round of rebirths. So Stephen proposes instead that the cessation of craving opens us up and allows us into cultivating another way of life. that craving is basically blocking us from engaging in the world in appropriate ways. And that is the direction of the practice. Not transcending this world, but moving into engagement, appropriate engagement in the world. Now, this is a more radical reframing of the Four Noble Truths. This notion of the transcendent result of the path, this transcending the cycle of rebirth, is pretty deeply embedded, pretty far back into Buddhist thought. It can be seen to some extent in the suttas. The question Stephen is raising is how much of that was added later. So I do just what I want to do now is to highlight some of the teachings in the Buddhist, the Pali Canon, that point to this notion of transformation in this life as being a point of the practice. Because I have done some exploration of this, in particular through studying one sutta called the Atthakavagga. This sutta is widely considered to be one of the oldest texts of the Buddhist canon. Based on that, it's not certain whether it's one of the earliest teachings of the Buddha, but it is actually referred to in some of the other suttas. And so it is one of the few texts that is referred to within the texts themselves. So it's a pretty core teaching, and it's a pretty old teaching. And this sutta, this text, is basically an exploration of clinging and the results of clinging. Letting go of clinging and the results of letting go of clinging. It describes this through what happens to us here and now when we cling. What happens to us here and now when we let go of clinging. People who cling are described by the results that happen in their life here and now. I'll read you just a few examples of what kinds of things it says. A man who is greedy is overpowered with weakness and trampled by trouble, for pain invades him as water a cracked boat. Grief, lamentation, and selfishness are not let go by those greedy for mine. There's many more. Let's see if I can find some more. I'll leave it at that. That's enough. People who are awakened are described by how they behave and what their qualities of mind are in this life. I'll read you some of this. Somebody is asking the Buddha to describe the ultimate person. And the Buddha says, a person who is not angered, not frightened, not boastful, and not worrying, who gives wise advice, is not agitated, is careful in speech, a person who does not cling to the future nor sorrow over the past, is not led astray by views, a person who is retiring, not deceitful, not covetous, not selfish, not impudent, not arousing contempt, who does not engage in malicious speech, who does not relish pleasure, who is not conceited, who is mild and of ready wit, who is not credulous and not bored. It goes on and on in this way. It doesn't, in one place it talks about, It's someone in whom no craving is found for either life or not life. So it brings up, in a few places in this text, it brings up this idea of future existences and this rebirth notion. But mostly it talks about that someone who has overcome craving and clinging is not concerned about future existences. It doesn't talk about whether there are or aren't future existences. It talks about the person who has overcome clinging is no longer concerned about it. So most of the references to future existences are in this form of somebody who has let go of clinging is no longer obsessed with thinking about what's going to happen to me when I die. So the core of the teaching of this text is non-clinging. And that, I believe, is really one of the fundamental tenets that the Buddha taught. I have no problem with saying the Buddha taught non-clinging. And there was one time, I believe, he said, somebody asked him to teach his teaching in brief, and he said, "Nothing is to be clung to as I, me, or mine." So non-clinging. And the results of non-clinging being visible in this life. This is very much what Stephen said, that not craving opens us to this appropriate seeing, thinking, speaking, acting, etc. Also in the suttas, it talks about this definition of nibbana, the definition of full awakening, is usually described in terms of what it's not. Here is a definition: the extinction of greed, the extinction of hate, the extinction of delusion. This indeed is called nibbana. Now, we can envision, at least I can envision, I can have a sense of what it might mean to be free of greed, hatred, and delusion in this very life. And going on in another sutta, the Buddha says, "Enraptured with lust, enraged with anger, blinded by delusion, overwhelmed, with mind ensnared, man aims at his own ruin, at the ruin of others, at the ruin of both, and he experiences mental pain and grief." Again, this definition is all about this life, what's happening here and now. "But if lust, anger, and delusion are given up, man aims at neither his own ruin, nor at the ruin of others, nor at the ruin of both, and he experiences no mental pain and grief. This is nibbana, immediate, visible in this life, inviting, attractive, and comprehensible to the wise." So Stephen is not the only one who has tried to explain the Buddhist teachings without recourse to this rebirth. Another contemporary example of somebody who was very interested in this was the great Thai Buddhist teacher of the last century, Ajahn Buddhadasa, who explored the Buddhist teaching and concluded for himself through looking at the suttas that rebirth is irrelevant to the Buddhist teachings, that the teachings, he particularly is exploring this teaching on the cycle of dependent origination, the cycle of how suffering is created, and says it describes here and now, moment to moment, how suffering is created in our experience, and that's where we need to pay attention. So personally, I myself am more inspired by this in this life notion of liberation. I have found and experienced benefits, results directly in my life of these teachings. And that is my joy and inspiration for continuing this practice, not because it may lead me to no longer have rebirth. And I agree with Stephen in that he says it's kind of a win-win situation. You know, if in fact there are future lives and this path is what will allow us to end our suffering in all, you know, in the suffering, the cycle of suffering for future lives, great, I'm on the path. If not, I'm happier here and now. So it's a win-win situation from my perspective. So, just to come back to this idea of views, are the views that we're working with, using, holding to engage in the path, are they skillful with respect to letting go of clinging? That's really the core, including clinging to views, as I talked about last week. The notion of clinging, letting go of all forms of clinging, even clinging to views, is, in my understanding, the path towards freedom in this life. So there's a couple of minutes if there's any comments or thoughts or yeah.
You gave that quote about not being concerned about living or not living, and then talked about how that was, you linked that to future lives and rebirth. And I was wondering if there was another interpretation, which would be that the person's not concerned about in this life when it will end.
Certainly you could interpret it that way also, yeah. Yeah, there are some other quotes that are more directly pointing to future lives. I think there's one. Can't find it. Well, I can't find it. It was something along the lines of with sorrow, lamentation, engaging in unskillful actions. The person wonders what will happen to me, or bemoans what will happen to me when I die. So there are references to it in that form. But again, in that particular case, it's somebody worrying about the future, as opposed to, just here and now. So yes, there are other interpretations, and in fact, in one study that I read about this text, the person went through every single reference to what looked like might be future existences, and looked at, does it have to refer to future existences, or can it refer to some way of looking in here and now in this life? So yes, you can look at it that way also. It's 9:00, so thank you for your attention.